Donal in the Kitchen talks about food. Donal in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donal in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donal in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And our kitchen table is right here in the middle of KHOI Community Radio in Ames, Iowa. We couldn't do it without them. Thanks for their support. Well, fall. There's so many good things that happen in the fall, and we're going to be talking about fall harvest favorites and what to do with them. We've got some suggestions, but first I'd like to mention apples. Apples this time of year, and in the Midwest we have lots of local orchards, thank goodness, and we have apples. You can find Jonathan, Honeycrisp, Gala, Jonna Gold, Fuji, Braeburn, Jonna Dell, Cortland, Zestar, Empire. Donna, what's your favorite apple?
Well, I don't like sweet and mushy apples. I have a whole thing about it. You know, I hardly ever, I'm real cynical on Honeycrisp and some of these new things that people seem to love and, you know, go for it. An apple is an apple, right? An apple a day keeps the doctor away. But I like the old, more tart ones. I want the apple to have a little bite. I love Braeburns, Cortlands, Zestars, Empires, you know, things like that. And the older varieties, usually.
Yeah, there's a variety called McCune.
Oh, my goodness. Those are wonderful if you can find them.
I found those a couple years ago at the berry farm. It is not in high production.
That's right. Yeah. Out at the berry patch, they have lots and lots of Honeycrisp, but they also have lots of older trees with really, at this point, rare varieties.
Yeah, and I found out that McCune was kind of the base apple that they bred other apples off of. So thanks goodness for those, and those are real tasty. I have a favorite that is growing on my farm, and it doesn't produce a lot all the time, but this year I got a few. I like Northern Spies, Donna.
Oh, yeah, you gave me a taste on Sunday. I love a Northern Spy, and you're right. They're scarce as hen's teeth, as they say these days.
Maybe it's just my tree, which I'm not much of an orchardist, but it does give apples every now. Three nice things about Northern Spy. It's a good keeper, comes late in the season, tastes really good, and it's really crisp and very tasty, and it's generally a large apple. So if you're into making apple pies, why peel and core
10 little ones.
10 little ones when you can use 6 big ones. I do like Northern Spy. And I believe there is a story. The Northern Spy refers to Underground Railroad sort of things. Going along with, it was kind of developed post-Civil War or mm-hmm. during the Civil War. And Northern Spy, there's probably a name that was the Northern Spy, but that's what it kind of refers to. Anyway, good stuff.
Yeah,
good
eat stuff. Your apples and taste lots of different kinds.
Taste lots of different kinds. Now is the time. Apples. And on the show today, we're going to be talking about some fall harvest favorites. Lots of good things to happen in the garden this time of year.
Well, today on the Donal in the Kitchen, Donna and I are going to talk about fall recipes. It's time for soups, for stews, for comfort food. Donna, talk about squash.
Oh, okay. That, I have to say, is probably my favorite vegetable. I mean, I like a lot of other ones, but squash. Now, we're going to be very specific about, because there are some squashes that are just yummy, creamy, dark, deep, delicious, full of carotenoids, and other squashes don't taste like much at all.
That's true.
And how does that happen? Well, and this is winter squashes. Yeah. We're not talking zucchini or patty pan. These are in the, you know, like pumpkins and butternut and buttercup, kabocha, some acorns. Those are my favorite.
They're the winter things. They're the winter things. There's lots of different kinds of squash. I kind of get myself around and want to answer some questions. So I got out my book called Seed to Seed by Susan Ashworth. It's a seed savers book, and it tells you about how to grow and save seeds from just about everything. And she has a little chapter on squash. We're talking about the cucurbita, the species of cucurbita. And there are actually four major squash that we call squash.
Hard squash.
And then there are two other ones that are kind of strange, and they are grown probably in Mexico and places south.
Tropical.
Yeah, one is called Cucurbita fififolia, and that is also called the Malabar gourd. That's in Mexico, and they use that for candy, I hear tell. And
so then, gourds are in the squash family.
Yeah, gourd, yes, okay. They are. And there's one called Cucurbita fetidissima, and
Fetid,
as in this one stinks. So we will not be talking about that one, and it's not grown around here anyway. But their summer squash, winter squash, and pumpkin are three commonly used terms that we confuse us. All squash and pumpkins can be eaten when they're young and tender, huh? And also when they mature. And varieties have been selected for keeping qualities, dried flesh. Those are known as the winter squash. Others have tender young skin, and that's of summer squashes. Squashes belong to the genus Cucurbita and to one of six different species. Now, there's in this book called Seed to Seed by Suzanne Ashworth, there are pages and pages of lists of names because squash, they have turned into, have been bred into many, many, many different kinds. The Cucurbita maxima. In that we will find your pumpkins, your pie pumpkins, your giant things, banana squashes, buttercup squashes, Hubbard's big old things, marrows, and turbans, like Turk's turban. Good one. Cucurbita mixta are your kushaws. Solid little green and white things. Cucurbita moschata. Our butternuts, cheeses, which are light-skinned and quite nice, the cheeses. Cucurbita pepo. There are a couple of summer squashes in here and zucchini-type things. Zucchinis are in this cucurbita pepo things. Cocozels, crooknecks. But scalloped and patty pan and sweet dumpling are also in this of species.
Well, it's funny that they're all in the same species because it's like, as much as I love winter squash and it's my favorite vegetable, I would have to say that zucchini and patty pan are my least favorite vegetable because I find for the most part, well, I would say they have no flavor, but basically they have a very subtle flavor. So I'm not so interested in them. Now, as a gardener, is it true that squash is crossbreed very easily and get quite kind of confused about their identity?
Oh, they do. They do. They're quite promiscuous. They will naturally cross with other subspecies.
Squash varieties. Squash
within their subspecies. And so you really, unless you're really careful and know what you're doing, don't bother saving seeds because it'll turn out to be something else. Unless you just happen to be growing one kind.
Okay, now, this is something I don't understand as a gardener. If, for example, you have a backyard garden and your neighbor across the fence also has a backyard garden, how far is that pollen going to travel? Like, if you wanted to keep your species separate, what are we're not talking about miles, right?
Well, I've heard quarter mile because they are pollinated by bees and other flying things. So there you go. Hmm. Got to be kind of careful there, but luckily you can generally find all kinds of fun varieties of squashes to grow. I had really good luck with growing, and there's new varieties too. Speaking of breeding, I had really good luck growing one called Honey Nut, which is a butternut cross. And so butternuts are the one that looks like a peanut. It's kind of tan and long. But this one is tan and long, but a little darker, and the flesh is darker.
And it has more flavor than your average butternut squash.
Yeah. I also like to grow, the squash that don't have a lot of flavor, I think acorns, big deal, acorns. But I grew a white kind that I found from Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. It's called Thelma Sanders, and it is a white
acorn.
White acorn. And that one actually, I sort of like. I like it because it's early.
I thought it was delicious. Lana gave me one too, and I'm kind of like, actually, several weeks before, I had bought a very light acorn at the Fairway or something, and I cooked it up, and it had no flavor. Zero, zero, zero. So then when I did Lana's, it was gorgeous. Really, really nice. It used to be, so squash, acorn squash, was the only vegetable my father would ever eat. And the reason you would eat it is because growing up, and this is the only way we fixed squash as a kid, it was always acorn, and you put either brown sugar or maple syrup and some butter in it and roast it up. And, of course, it's delicious.
Yeah.
But I do find I'm kind of picky about where I'll shop for squash, because although sometimes the average squash that you get at the grocery store has flavor, sometimes they don't. I tend to do better at the farmer's market with them. I don't know why that is. Do you know, Laura?
Well, here's an idea. They really need to be ripe. They need to develop those sugars in them to really be tasting really good. They have to be picked, and they have to be picked, and the stem has to be left on, in my experience, or they just never, ever develop any taste at all. If the stem breaks off, and you happen to know that the stem was really dry and it was probably a good ripe squash in the field, use that one right away because it won't last. The stem helps.
Oh, the ones without stems don't store as well.
Don't store as well. Also, I've come to find out, and maybe the farmers at Farmers Market do this too. When you pick your squash, let them cure in the sunshine. Not necessarily full sun, but, you know, kind of on your porch maybe. Let them cure for a week outside. So when they're off the vine, the stem that is still attached hardens up. And as a squash sits there and is stored in your dark, cool place in your house, they keep ripening like apples do. The sugars keep getting a little better and a little better if they're ripe to start with.
So that means if you're buying them at the grocery store, you should look for ones that have the stem still attached.
Oh, yes, please do. Yes.
Okay.
That's a good start.
Okay, anyway. That's a good tip from Lana. Okay.
Okay.
Because that means, there's nothing more disappointing than to buy a squash and have it have no flavor.
It's true.
I tend to buy, sometimes the only hard squash you can find are acorns. And also, this is really true of pumpkins. I don't know, but I think in my lifetime, we have been breeding pumpkins mostly for show.
Oh, sure.
So those pumpkins usually, 99% of the time, have zero interesting flavor.
Right.
You know, they're just not worth it. Some of them are quite gorgeous. Like right now at the grocery store, there's some real charming examples for setting out, you know, for Halloween or even for harvest. But those are not the ones. They now have something that's designated as pie pumpkins pumpkin pie. However, though, and I have said this before, and on our recipe website, we have a recipe for pumpkin cobbler, which is a real easy peasy. I always make it for Thanksgiving, but it's good other times too. And that is, you make a batter and you have already cooked your pumpkin and you pour them in together and bake them. But I don't use pumpkin. I use usually a butternut or a buttercup or kabocha squash. I go for the squash that has the most deep flavor, because by the time you put those pumpkin pie spices in it, the depth of the flavor just, you know, it just jumps and it makes a really delicious, you know, so I would suggest when you start to think about pumpkin pies that you maybe make them with squash instead.
Actually, I think you told me that even if you buy a can of pumpkin, sometimes it's...
Right. The Libby's canned pumpkin that is most commonly, I think that's the brand, but maybe other brands too. Those most commonly are not actually pumpkin, but are butternut squashes. And in fact, a great deal of them seem to be grown in Illinois for some reason.
Well, seems like a good
place. So if you're starting from scratch with your, and it really is easy with a pumpkin, you can either, you can steam them, cut them open, cut the seeds out and steam them with some water, or you can roast them. And I like roasting a lot because it concentrates the sugars in the pumpkin and makes it really yummy. But steaming is particularly good too if you're going to make soup out of the pumpkin, which I often do. You save the water that you've steamed it in, mm-hmm. because that's good to add to the soup.
You recently made a really nice, use a container.
This is another roasting trick. So you take usually I use something dark green and round, not a butternut, but a buttercup or a kabocha, one of those more substantial that looks like maybe sort of like a little green pumpkin or something like that.
Harder skin.
Yeah, harder skin. And then I cut the lid off of it like you would in carving a pumpkin. You just go around and you lift it out and cut the seeds off it, scrape it out so that you have a hollow bowl. Then into that, you can put some pre-cooked mixture. Like I did it two nights ago. I did it with a bolognese, a meat spaghetti sauce. I just made a homemade sauce. It was really yummy. I poured it into the squash, put the whole thing on a roasting sheet, stuck the lid back on it, and put it in the oven, like 350, 375, and just let it cook with the sauce in it. Now, when it's done, you can't really set a timer exactly because it depends on how thick the squash was or how big, but I kept poking it with a skewer or a pointy knife in the lid till it was soft enough to go all the way through. You can fill it with something like I did with a bolognese sauce. You could put chili in it. You could put, I had an old recipe from New Mexico, which was just tomatoes and chili peppers. No beans, no nothing. But any kind of saucy thing inside it. So then when you take it out, you cut off a piece of the pumpkin and then you've got the sauce on it and it's really yummy. It's a very fun presentation for children too, or at a dinner party.
Very good. I never think of taking squash in different directions. I'm kind of your old brown sugar maple syrup person myself, but I guess you can do lots of different
things. Used to do stuffed squash with acorns.
Yeah.
You put some kind of either bread stuffing or rice stuffing, or you could probably use a meat and sausage stuffing even in an acorn and roast it up like that. Make little dishes.
Good.
Now, the other thing to remember about squashes is because they're really versatile. So I'm going to talk about is it time to talk about the cookbook yet?
Oh, it certainly is.
Okay. So there is, just hot off the press, a new Otto Linge cookbook. Now, he writes these big, gorgeous cookbooks, and I have almost all of them. This one is called Flavor. So Yotam Otto Linge is, I can't remember if he's Israeli or Palestinian, and there is a distinction. But anyway, he's from that part of the world, and he opened a restaurant in London that has been wildly successful for a number of years. And then he writes these fabulous cookbooks that really have a lot of Mediterranean influences because that's the kind of cuisine that he does. So this new one is called Flavor, as I said, and it's predominantly vegetables. It has plenty of vegan recipes and vegetarian, but you don't think about it, oh, here's a vegetarian cookbook, because it's just why I like his recipes is he always introduces me to a different seasoning concept that I go, oh, right, I I could do that, spice it up a little, change things, you know, it keeps you from getting bored as a cook. So this new one, he breaks it down because it's called flavor. He talks about process. So he describes charring, browning, infusing, and aging. Then the next part of the book is about pairing. So he talks about balancing, and you do this as you cook instinctively, especially if you're making your own recipes.
Pairing is in putting things together, not pairing like peeling.
No. P-A-I-R-I-N-G. You're balancing the sweetness, the fat, the acidity, and the heat. Huh? And so he talks about doing that. And then he has a whole, like, he has something called flavor bombs. This is, let me give you some examples of what the flavor bombs are. These are little condiments that he makes, basically, that you can add in. So, oils and butters. Black lime and pumpkin seed butter, chili oil, fenugreek marinade, lime leaf butter, numbing oil. That must be with Szechuan peppers, right? Smoked cassabelle oil. Cascabel, that must be I don't even know what that one is. Three garlic butter. Then another pile is salsas and dressings. Blood orange nam jim. So he does get some Asian influences as well as Mediterranean. Charred chili salsa. Cilantro chutney. Quick chili sauce. Sweet tamarind dressing and tahini and soy dressing. Huh. Condiments and pickles. This one, Lana and I have agreed she's going to grow curry leaf next summer because you cannot find it around here.
I have found, I realize that curry is not just a mixture of things. There is a plant called curry leaf. Give it a try.
But he goes, curry leaf mayonnaise, date barbecue sauce, hibiscus pickled onions, and then nuts and sprinkles, chipotle peanuts, and nori and sesame salt. So he just has a lot of really good ideas. Now, he has some squash recipes. Here we go. This one, this one is called a butternut orange and sage galette. So basically, you take the rough pastry crust, you know, and roll it out for like I used to call it a rustic tart, right? So it's roasting it with the squash on it and then some sage.
Do you cook the squash before you put it on the galette?
I don't know. Let's see.
I think you would because you don't cook
seed. Small butternut squash, skin on, seeded and sliced 1/2 inch.
Oh.
No, so maybe you roast it in The other one, he had two more that I thought were wonderful combinations for squash. Esme's rough squash mash. So basically you're making squash like a mashed potato, right? And here's what she's putting in there. So butternut squash is what they were using. Olive oil, maple syrup, white miso paste, which is a great idea. Two jalapenos, then cinnamon, cumin, garlic, and limes at the end. Fresh zest, and then a little juice, and then top it with green onions. I mean, I love that recipe. It's something that went, oh, right, I could go in a completely different direction.
Would think of putting jalapenos and lime with squash.
Why not?
Well, here we are.
Yeah.
We bring you new ideas here on the Donna Lana Kitchen, and I think I'm going to put lime on my grocery list right now. Yes, I am.
Well, and here's a third other recipe. Israeli couscous and squash in tomato with star anise sauce. That sounds really, really an interesting push too.
Yeah, because there sits your star anise waiting for Christmas. I never use it again. It's a wonderful smell. It's a wonderful thing.
So what else do you think? So it's cinnamon, cloves, onions, a little sugar, star anise, chili, tomatoes, tomato paste. And then they add it with the Israeli couscous. You can put it on small pasta too. I mean, Israeli couscous is that they're like tapioca sized couscous. They're really a pasta. And they mix it with baby spinach and cilantro. Now, I make squash soup a lot. So either sometimes I roast and scrape it out of the skin. One thing I hate and I never do, if a recipe says to peel the squash, I just don't do it.
Oh, that's really gutsy.
Well, I don't do it while it's raw. If you cook it, so either roast it or steam it, it's much easier to peel it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one of my idiosyncrasies here, but I get lazy about that. Because peeling squash, it's not like peeling carrots. They're hard, you know, it takes a lot of knife work. So my basic go-to for like a squash soup is, either steam it or roast it. It doesn't matter, and kind of scrape it out of the skin afterwards. And then you use if you've steamed it, you put the stock from the water from the pan. You can also put a chicken stock in. And I like to go with coconut milk.
Oh,
coconut milk and squash make it real. You're going kind of Asian with this. And then you can add either curry powder or like even that Taste of Thai red chili paste.
Mm-hmm.
That works really well. And it's really simple. You just put those things in. You blend it up and bing, bang, bong, you got a great squash. It's soup. Really. And you can,
What?
We didn't talk about the brown butter sage yet.
Oh, let's take a break. Listen to some music.
We'll come back with the brown butter.
So many good tastes here because squash is just the beginning, folks.
Squash is so exciting.
Well, squash is just so, so, so exciting. This is KHOI 89.1. You are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Kitchen. We're talking squash here, and we kind of get into pumpkins a little bit here. The difference between pumpkins and winter squashes is like really confusing. In the United States, small round orange squashes used for pies and jack-o'-lanterns are referred to as pumpkins. However, the term pumpkin, it is also used for field pumpkins, as in the jack-o'-lantern kinds. Actually, all pumpkins are squash. Write that down. All pumpkins are squash. Pumpkins are not even a subspecies group. Donna mentioned earlier, squash come in so many different shapes, sizes, and colors. Let's enjoy all that pretty stuff. Yes, yes, yes.
But some of them are not worth eating.
So, well,
the field pumpkins, for example.
No. No, carve that one and put a candle in it, perhaps, and put it on your front steps. So we're talking squash and pumpkins. Do you have anything else to say about squash and pumpkins, son?
Well, we were gonna talk about the brown butter sage.
Oh.
Which goes very well with squash. So while we were taking in all the ends of the garden, I ran out and snipped all of my sage and actually leaned on a few of my friends and neighbors for more sage. And yesterday I made the brown butter sage, which is basically you're using butter to fry the sage leaves until they're really crispy and dark.
Ooh.
And then, of course, in that process, the butter turns brown, too, and very nutty. And so I took a whole pound of butter and a lot of sage, like a, I don't know, a volleyball-sized bouquet of sage. You pick the stems off, and you drop them all in the butter in a skillet, and you just kind of cook them and stir them and cook them and stir them till they get all crispy.
And don't let it burn.
Very close to burning. Oh, okay. Very close, because you want them dark. You know, you want them really cooked and really crispy. But this, once it's done, you just put it in a container in the fridge, and it will keep for, 6 weeks maybe, or at least a month. I mean, I push it. But it is a way to conserve it, and it's yummy. So if you're, for example, making squash soup, you can just puree the squash and put in your, you know, either your stock or your water or whatever. And not coconut milk, because this is not Asian. This is if you're going more Italian. Then you season it with the brown butter and then puree the whole thing together. So the brown butter, the sage and the squash is a really good combination. It's also, like last night we just boiled up some ravioli for dinner, and we just put some of that brown butter sage right onto the ravioli, and it was so good. And what else do we use brown butter? Oh, well, the traditional one is cannellini or white beans.
Oh,
cook them up and then season them at the end with some of this brown butter sage. That is really, really delicious. But it's good on pasta. It's good even added to a tomato sauce on pasta. It gives you that very autumnal, sagey, savory, umami kind of feeling. So now is the season to get that brown butter sage in the fridge. I mean, you can all year long buy the sage and either fry it up, or it's something you have to make yourself, though. You can't just go out and buy it.
Good.
So I made some yesterday and put it on the ravioli.
Very good. Brown butter sage. I have tried and tried many years to keep sage plants in the garden, but they just don't kind of like at least the kind of sage I grow. It doesn't quite make it over the winter, but it's not too bad to start it in the house as a seed. Or this year, I just plain dug up the sage plants. Okay, I'm kind of hedging my bets here. I've got sage plants in like three different...
Oh, in your greenhouse. You brought them in.
I brought them in. So I've got one in the ground in my greenhouse, and it freezes there eventually, but not as hard as it would outside. I've got another one in the greenhouse in a pot, so I can really at the last minute pull it in if I have to. And I also have a sage plant I intend to keep probably in a cool bedroom by a window. It doesn't like super hot. So, I mean, not over the winter. You're trying to make it sleep a little bit. But it does like light. So I'm hoping that I can fuss over some sage plants. These sage plants, when I repotted them, I did cut them back. So I do have dried sage hanging up in my kitchen. So, and like my lemon verbena, you cut the thing back. They're woody. They're a woody plant. So give them a nice big pot. Cut them back. Don't cut off all the green. Leave a little bit at the bottom there and talk to them nicely. I always have some sage plant come back, but it never is as good left in the garden as if I fuss with them in the house.
Do you bring your rosemary in, or do you let it overwinter?
I bring my rosemary in because that too, it'll come back, but it's so wimpy that
it's not happy.
Dig them up. Put them in the greenhouse, put one in a pot by the window,
rosemary, I think, is a particularly good plant to put in the window, because unlike a basil where you need a lot of it, just a little bit of rosemary, is delicious.
That's
so
true.
So even if you have a, you know, small to medium sized plant, it can go a long way over the winter. It is a good plant to bring in the house and have a fresh herb. And we like those flavors in the winter a lot, the sage and the rosemary.
Very good. I have also got a red opal basil going in a pot, and we'll see how that does. It will not like the cooler winter, but as a house plant, it's hanging in there, and I have
seen it's pretty.
It's pretty. So I just see it's a little house plant thing, and there you go. So we wish the best for the winter plants coming in, getting dried. We're making a transition from the outside to the inside. Oh, brown butter sage. You said it lasts in the refrigerator for a long time. I don't think it would last very long for me, so we would just plain eat it. And since you turned me on to this brown butter thing, which just is a really good invention, I want to mention the recipe. This recipe is also on our Dialana Kitchen website, I believe, because I discovered it last year. It's from a book called Genius Desserts, 100 Recipes That Will Change the Way You Bake. Thank you to the nice person who gave this to me for Christmas last year. The editor is Kristen McGlure. And it's a collection of dessert recipes. And this is the person that made this recipe.
I have to interject a warning here.
Yeah.
Do not make this recipe unless you prepare to eat the whole damn thing. It's really good. It's just
a disclaimer. And we're talking brown butter here. It's salted brown butter. Crispy treats. So, do you remember like Rice Krispies? Here's the truth. The classic recipe that's been printed on the Rice Krispies box since 1940 is already a genius dessert. It's ready in 10 minutes without heating the oven. Three ingredients, cereal, marshmallows, butter. We tend to not even think of it, but here is another truth. Most people will walk past all sorts of fancy cookies and tarts to get to the stack of Rice Krispie treats before the rest of us can make all of them.
Amen.
And now that's just the regular Rice Krispie with the recipes from the box. Here's a modern riff from Deb Perlman. And she wrote a book called Smitten Kitchen.
Oh, yes. Oh, Smitten Kitchen.
This has the same crunch and goo and wonderful stuff as the old ones. Only difference are that you sizzle the butter instead of just melting it. You sizzle until the milk solids have turned toasty brown and add salt to balance the sweet. And, well, why not? Instead of the 3 tablespoons of butter that were in the original recipe, use a whole stick, why not? And brown all of that, okay? Brown it.
No wonder they were so good I couldn't stop eating them. Oh, my goodness.
However, you might be tempted to brown the marshmallows too, but don't. It only turns the bars stiff and dry, and they are really good. They're kind of like Rice Krispie treats for adults because they look the same. They're good, but bite into it, and it's brown butter, and it's a little salt for a little
cake. It's a great, brilliant recipe.
It is on the Dialana Kitchen website, and you can go to khoifm.org, find the Dialana show under the talk section, and there's lots of things there. There's past shows, but go to recipes. You'll find salted brown butter crispy treats.
Make them for Halloween for yourself.
This is next week as you're thinking about Halloween treats, I think all of us deserve a little treat.
I'm going to do that thing we've been talking about for the pandemic where you know, I've been making different things for my neighbors and just, we've been having these exchanges where you leave something on their porch and then something comes back a few days later. I think I'm going to do the brown butter. Yep. Rice Krispie treats for Halloween for them.
That's good. You said you attempted to do this recipe, but you used a different kind of marshmallow.
Oh, that was silly. I ended up buying a vegan marshmallow, which I did not intend to. And then, of course, they didn't melt the same way because they don't have gelatin in them. So I will use the real, normal, commercial marshmallows because that's what works.
Yeah, just go ahead and just do the marshmallow treats, Rice Krispies, because you can't really improve on a good thing. And yes, they're rich, but Rice Krispie treats for adults.
That would be why it's a good idea to give some of them away, because then you won't eat them all yourself.
Oh, Donna, what about brown butter sage in there?
I was thinking about that.
Maybe,
I don't
not
know.
With the sweet, right? Not with the sweet.
I don't know.
It already has salt in it.
It would be kind of interesting. I don't know.
Oh, I could throw a jalapeno pepper. I don't know. No.
I don't know. That's pretty. The beauty about this recipe is it is so close to the classic one that your mother made.
Yes.
Your whole life, right? Yes. I mean, I can remember my mother even when I was living on a different coast from her, she would make the Rice Krispie treats and put it in a Bundt pan. So it was like, or an angel food pan. Oh. And cause you can mold it, right? And then she'd wrap it up in foil and send it to my children for their birthday cakes. Through the mail.
That's a good birthday
cake. I know.
Cake.
Yes, it does. Ooh. So the brown butter one version is so close to the original with just a little enough to make it even more delicious.
There you go. We're talking brown butter. We're talking recipes for fall here. And this is KHOI. Remind you again, this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Go to khoifm.org. Support this fine radio station and find the Donna Lana Kitchen recipe page there. You'll be able to find the brown butter Rice Krispie treat recipe and Donna's pumpkin cobbler recipe and other stuff too. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. It was a little waltz there. I hope you were dancing around the kitchen table there with your cat or your fellow housemate. Always dance. Dance. Even by yourself. So, Donna, you can eat this all any time, but I like this time of year. You make a really good thing. So tell us what's up next.
Oh, buckwheat. I don't know. Buckwheat feels so hearty and nutritious, and it's one of my favorite things, which I think it's an underestimated thing in our cuisine. Buckwheat is actually, it's not a grain. What is it?
It's a seed.
Yeah.
Buckwheat, believe it or not.
Well, they're all seeds.
But it isn't. It's related to rhubarb, believe it or not.
Yeah, it's in the, yeah.
And it doesn't have a grass kind of head. It has a little clump of white flowers that bees absolutely love. And it makes little seeds that are little, triangles, look like little pyramids, teeny tiny little black pyramids. And they're quite nice. They are quite nice.
And it grows well in Iowa, and it's very good as either a cover crop or puts more nutrients into your soil.
Suppresses weeds.
Yep. It's and we have early morning harvest in Panora, does grow and mill buckwheat flour. So we can have Iowa buckwheat flour, which is what I use all the time. And my favorite for the flour, I mean, you can also cook it whole, and those are called buckwheat groats, which is a whole another kind of cooking thing. But the flour is a lot of things can be changed. A recipe can be modified by adding just a little, like 20% buckwheat flour or something, and you get a completely different result. Obviously, it doesn't have gluten in it, and you cannot substitute buckwheat for wheat in anything that is rising. But you can put some in. But what I like to make are buckwheat crepes. Now, traditionally, in France, they're called galettes, and it's in Brittany, which is the most western part of Europe. It's the part of France that sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean, kind of pointing to England. And they have a Gaelic culture there, and they grow a lot of buckwheat. So a crepe, as we think of it, is actually a dessert crepe in Brittany, and the savory ones are made with buckwheat. But making them the French way, you have to have the right pan, and they're really, you know, there's a whole knack to it. So I have a sort of an American version that's not quite the same as a pancake, but it's not quite the same as a French crepe. It's a little thicker than a French crepe. And I just use my cast iron skillet, my well-seasoned cast iron skillet, to make them. And they're really, like a typical thing is you bake the crepe, or you cook it in the cast iron skillet. And then when it's, you know, done and you flipped it once, then you can crack an egg on it and cook the egg on it and maybe put a little sprinkle of cheese on it. And if you want to drop some basil on or some other herb, you can do that. But the batter is great because you do need to let it sit a little bit, but you can also sit it in the refrigerator, and over several days you can just make one crepe at a time or two, you know, or whatever. So it's kind of a nice go-to in the fridge. And the recipe is really simple. It's 2 cups of liquid, which I actually use milk, which makes it thicker and more nutritionally dense, 1 1/4 cups of buckwheat, 3 eggs, 1/4 cup of oil, and I use canola. Sometimes I use olive. It really, you don't lose it with that, and a pinch of salt. So you let it sit. You just put that all in together and whisk it so you don't have lumps in it, and you let it sit like a half an hour or an hour or however long you want, or, you know, in the fridge. And then you just ladle. I take my cast iron pan and I take a little bit of oil, usually olive oil, and I smooth it around the pan with just a napkin or a piece of paper towel. So you don't need too much oil, but you do want to coat the pan.
And you want to make it sure it's hot.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And then you heat the pan up, and then you put a ladle full of this batter in, and you kind of just, you know, roll the pan around a little till it spreads, and then you let it cook enough till it kind of slightly bubbles, and you can see it has no baking powder or anything, so it doesn't rise like a typical pancake does, but you can see when it needs to be flipped, and then you end up with a quick and easy facsimile of a crepe, but you get that buckwheat sensation. So I'm going to tell you again, 2 cups of liquid, milk or water or, you know, something like that. And, or you could do 1 cup of milk and 1 cup of water too, if you wanted a little lighter. 1 1/4 cup of buckwheat flour, not the groats, but the flour. 3 eggs. It's very eggy, which is what makes it easy to, like a French crepe often will have either way less egg or no egg in the batter, which makes it harder to work with. And then 1/4 cup of oil and a pinch of salt. And there you have it. And that makes a really nice light winter supper.
That is a good winter thing. You mentioned before, groats. You can also eat buckwheat as a cooked grain. And it's called groat. I don't know why it's called groat.
I don't know. But it's fluffy and
kind of groaty. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But how I cook groats that I really like as a wintry grain is I toast it in a pan.
Oh, in a dry skillet.
I toast it so they get crunchy munchy. And now I read a recipe once where you first put it in a beaten egg and then toast it, or you don't have to. I don't know what the beaten egg does, but anyway, the groats themselves get kind of golden. They change color a little bit, and then you add water or stock to cover.
And another name for that dish is kasha. Is it sort of the Eastern Europe? Mm-hmm. So kasha is buckwheat groats. And they have to be, for the groats, they have to be the hulled buckwheat.
Yeah.
Right.
So they're white.
Right. It will say on the package, hulled buckwheat groats.
Good. It's also really good to add some sauteed
onions.
Garlic onions. Garlic onions, yes. Ooh, that's really good with that.
How about if we take the squash and we have the cooked buckwheat groats, and then we stuff the squash with that and put a little cheese on it and melt it in the oven?
Oh. Ooh. Donna, you're brilliant.
I'm hungry, I guess.
Buckwheat groats and squash. Oh.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a fall recipe or what? Oh. So.
And buckwheat groats are also nice for stuffings, like chicken or...
It's Thanksgiving turkey.
Yeah, we're already at Thanksgiving almost, so yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's a very nice grain. It really is. It's got a, and then considering it's out there with those in the field being a cover crop and being a grain, and it's got these wonderful little white flowers.
It's a very ancient grain from, it's a European grain that's been used for probably before wheat even.
And if you get buckwheat honey, bees that have been frequenting the buckwheat field, it is a dark, dark honey.
It's caramely-like.
I do.
I love it.
Some people think, no, that's not honey. Honey's got to be almost clear. No, these bees work for it, and it's a nice, dark buckwheat honey. I do like that. That is very good. Well, we've been talking about fall recipes and preparing for winter. I've been pulling things up. I harvested the last of my leeks, actually, yesterday, kind of pushed the snow out of the way. Leeks actually can stay in the ground pretty well.
You're not going to tell your leek joke, are you?
No.
Okay.
I'll tell my leek joke maybe later. Because it's a winter joke. But anyway, last of the leeks. I pulled those up. I grew leeks. I put in leeks that I ordered from a onion supply house that were already small plants, but I also grew leeks myself in the greenhouse from seed.
And brave.
It is a long process, I tell you. You have to plant those little suckers in February, but they do grow. They do grow. Little hairs come up, and I got quite a bunch of nice leeks. I planted the late maturing leeks. I grew them from seed because I know that leeks can grow into the cool weather and actually store in the ground pretty well. And these are the shorter, not the big fancy long leeks, but the shorter stocky.
The shorter fat ones?
Yeah, they're okay. Also, I have a question. We'd like to hear what's on your plate. If you have anything you would like to share with the Donalana Kitchen, you can email me at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. That's Lana, L-O-N-N-A, at onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. Find out what's on your plate. And I have a question to throw out there. Does anybody know how to deal with a hen that is laying astray? I have one small hen that does not want to lay in the house with everybody else. So I have always on a merry chase out in the field.
Is she being picked on by the other chickens?
No, this is a perfectly fine old hen that is kind of...
contrarian. I have a solution.
Yeah, what?
Put her in the pot.
I could do that. I mean, I hate to lose her eggs because I hear her out in the chicken. I have quite a big run for them, and there's a couple of piles of brush out there because I think the hens need something to do, so we leave some brush piles there for them to kick around.
She's playing hide and seek.
She goes underneath, and I know what a hen sounds like when it is laying an egg, and the sound has been coming from the far end of the chicken run, yep, way at the end, and not in the chicken house. So if anybody has, and I have to give them new bedding and new nest box material, I don't know what. So if anybody has any wisdom on hens, or as a recipe to share, go to onioncreekfarm@gmail.com. That's my email. We've been talking about recipes today. We talked about the book Seed to Seed by Karen Ashworth. We talked about the book Delicious Recipes, a Genius Recipes, Genius Desserts by Christine McGlure. And Donna, your book is called
Flavor, the newest addition to the Ottolenghi. They're big, heavy books. I got a whole collection of them. They're beautiful books, too.
Spell Ottolenghi.
Ottolenghi.
A good book. Good pictures. Lots of good things. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. You can find us here at KHOI Community Radio every Tuesday live at noon. repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. Music today by a band called Persons of Quality. You heard the tune Jolly Company and The Elephant Stairs. Support this radio station, KHOIFM.org. My name is Lana Nakago.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life. Thank you.